News Talk Saturday.
The United States military began major combat operations in Iran. Our objective is to defend the American people by eliminating imminent threats from the Iranian regime, a vicious group of very hard, terrible people. From Lebanon to Yemen and Syria to Iraq, the regime has armed, trained, and funded terrorist militias that have soaked the earth with blood and guts. And it was Iran's proxy, Hamas, that launched the monstrous October 7th attacks on Israel, slaughtering more than 1,000 innocent people, including 46 Americans, while taking 12 of our citizens hostage. It was brutal. Something like the world has never seen before.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to News Talk Saturday with me, Emmett Oliver. It's great to have you along this morning on this momentous day. Operation Epic Fury, as it has been termed by the U.S. Department of War, once called the U.S. Department of Defense, this morning. We have a lot to get through. We'll have massive coverage of all of this over the next 2 hours. We've got people in the region, we have people here in Ireland, and we have a lot of academic and also journalistic analysis of what's happening on the ground, the military aspects, and of course the diplomatic fallout that's likely to follow over the next few weeks. The New York Times reporting that this could last. This is a joint U.S.-Israeli action, bombing of Iran, Tehran, the capital, and various many other parts of the country. But we're also hearing about other explosions in the region more generally. We have reports in Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, and the Kuwait defense minister is saying they have also intercepted some missiles coming from Iran. So we are seeing the regionalization of what's happening. As I said, it's called Operation Epic Fury. We will be talking about this for the next few weeks. It's going to affect, of course, the oil price. It's going to affect the regional economy and possibly Western economies as well. We'll tease it all out. Let's get me to our two future guests, our two current guests that we have. Scott Lucas is a professor and he's a political analyst at the Clinton Institute at UCD. And we also have Mark Weiss, who's based live in Jerusalem with the Irish Times, and they're both joining me now. Mark, if I can come to you first, what exactly is happening in Israel? I understand the country's in a bit of lockdown as this attack was commenced a few hours ago.
Well, we see Israeli citizens received messages on their mobile phones at 10 past 8 local time that Israel was attacking Iran and we should stay close to our protected areas, either a safe room in a person's home or a collective bomb shelter. It was a matter of time before, probably before sirens would sound. And indeed, here in Jerusalem, sirens have been going off all morning. We're on maybe 6 or 7 times already, and we're only the beginning. Which means basically Israelis are confined now to their bomb shelters or safe rooms, following very closely the instructions from the Home Front Command. The instructions at the moment are to stay in the safe places until we receive the okay that it's you can leave. Workplaces are closed. Non-essential travel is advised against it. Celebrations tomorrow for the Jewish festival of Purim have been cancelled. All football matches have been cancelled. Any public gatherings have been cancelled. Hospitals have evacuated non-essential patients, making way for the possibility that there will be rocket strikes that will hit civilian centres and hospitals on emergency footing.
And Mark, have anyone in Israel or beyond that been told what the objectives are of this military combat? Has the Israeli government communicated those to the population?
There was a message from the Prime Minister announcing the launch of the war about an hour ago. It's clear that this time this is going to be a big and prolonged operation. At least 4 or 5 days of intensive, probably around-the-clock strikes against all elements of the Iranian military and the political leadership, along with major figures from the Revolutionary Guards under the siege. And the aim is quite clear. The aim, if you take together Netanyahu's speech and President Trump's announcement, that this time the aim is regime change.
Now, in previous instances like this, the Israeli anti-missile defence systems, of which there are many, have performed, and they've shot down most of the projectiles from Iran. So I suppose that's the crucial piece we don't know, is will they be able to defend Israel on this occasion from what's probably going to be even bigger retaliation from Iran. Is that correct?
I think that's a fair assessment. Given the scope of this operation, that remember is only in its opening hours, it's quite clear the Iranians will retaliate with whatever they've got, particularly if they feel the regime is in danger, and it looks at the moment that that may well be the case. Israeli interceptions are already taking place successfully as we speak, but it's probably a matter of time before the first rockets do get through Israel's multi-layer air defense systems and hit population centers. Israel is bracing for this. It happened last time, and it will probably happen again this time.
Okay, stay with us, Mark, for the moment. I'm going to go to our second guest, who's Professor Scott Lucas at UCD. Scott, good morning to you.
Very good morning.
Listen, there's a lot going on. This is a very multi-layered sort of story with lots of regional dimensions and a US dimension. But ultimately, what do you think the aim of the military action is? Is it regime change? And if it is, who would replace the current regime?
I mean, that's a great summary from Mark, because we need to be clear that, yes, this, even beyond Israel's attack last June, which was a 12-day war supported by the Americans, this time it is regime change. Specifically, the operations this morning are a combination of trying to knock out Iran's elite military positions, especially the Revolutionary Guards. And we have reports that there are casualties at Revolutionary Guards headquarters. But they also are going for the political leadership. There are explosions near or in the district where the president's offices are located, where the National Security Council is located. There are also reports that the Supreme Leader's offices have been targeted, although he is probably in hiding in a bunker well away from there. And also that the Assembly of Experts, which is an important body that chooses the Supreme Leader, they have been targeted. Your second question, however, is much more difficult, because there is no obvious successor to step into place if you take out the regime, because the regime for years, especially after the manipulated 2009 presidential elections, have decapitated the opposition. They have jailed many of the opposition's leaders. They have other opposition leaders have had to flee the country. The protests that we saw last month were very, very significant, but they didn't have a single leader as such. And of course, they were brutally repressed with the loss of thousands, maybe tens of thousands of lives. There are some in the Iranian diaspora, and maybe some in Iran, who might point to the son of the late Shah, Reza Pahlavi. He has actually promoted himself as a successor, but I'm not sure he has significant support inside Iran, especially if it appears that it is the U.S. and Israel trying to install him after this attack, this sustained attack on the nation.
I suppose the question none of us know is, can an aerial attack alone, despite its destruction and devastation, actually lead to regime change? Is there any possibility in the Trump administration that beyond an air-based attack, they might escalate even beyond that, whether it be boots on the ground and so on? Do you think they've counted that out, or do you think they still would hold that in reserve?
Well, I think boots on the ground are ruled out at this point for the Trump folks, because the one thing that will stop them would be domestic opposition. And Iraq 2003 and Afghanistan are so firmly implanted in American political culture, I don't think Trump can get his political supporters to back that, especially when he said, remember, I'm the president of peace who will not get us involved in foreign interventions. That's why there was a report earlier in the New York Times this week, which is significant here, which is that the Trump officials were saying, we're going to let Israel strike first because it's politically better that way. And by that, what I read is that although the U.S. has accompanied Israel today, it's Israel who are going after the military targets. I'm not sure the Americans are. So if the Israelis take out the regime's leader, then the Americans can say, all right, Iranians, you can come in and everything's going to be flowers and the streets paved with gold. The problem there is that didn't work out in Iraq 2003. It has not worked out in other countries. And I will repeat, last June, Israel, although it didn't declare it was going for regime change, tried to assassinate the political and military leaders. It killed more than 20 military commanders. But the Iranian people did not rise up at that point and say, we're taking power. if anything, many opponents of the regime, and I have many friends inside Iran, they rallied behind the nation. In other words, the U.S. and Israel were not attacking the regime. They were attacking Iran. And I think that's going to be a heavy burden for anyone in the Trump administration or Netanyahu's government who think they can remake the Islamic Republic just through these airstrikes.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that strikes me is we've got a statement in from Downing Street where they pretty much say they didn't really know much about it. It seems to be heavily unilateral. Maybe that's just the way Trump does things, but it's very much a U.S.-Israeli operation. From what I can make out, a lot of other capitals around the world weren't even informed of this, that it was happening, which would have happened under U.S. administrations of the past. So we know Trump is a unilateralist, but this is heavy unilateralism where he just pretty much doing things with Netanyahu without much reference to anybody else whatsoever.
I mean, the Trump camp have put their chips in with Israel now fully. Remember that Trump last June, actually, when the Iranians made a token demonstration attack on the American base in Qatar, but they didn't kill any American personnel because they warned them. Then Trump said to Netanyahu, you stand down. This time, the U.S. are in from the start. And you're quite right to point out that they're doing it with absolutely no support from elsewhere. This is a clear violation of international law. The UK has made that clear today. I think other European capitals will make that clear today. Their intelligence services knew this might happen this weekend. I actually heard about it from friends in the community yesterday. But knowing that this is going to happen and being consulted about it are two very, very different things. And I think what you're going to see is a paradox. You're going to actually see the Trump camp and Israel being isolated in waging this assault on Iran. But at the same time, I don't think anybody can limit them right now. I don't think the UN can limit them. I don't think former allies can limit them because they are dedicated to taking the regime change out. The one thing that I think could limit this is if the Iranians succeed in hitting American personnel in the region and cause casualties, that probably would reinforce a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill, as well as some Trump supporters who were very wary about the so-called president of peace going to war.
Yeah, we do have reports of attacks on U.S. military bases in the region. We don't know how extensive they are. We don't know very much at all, but we do have reports that there has been some activity at them. So how well protected would they be from missile attack? Presumably a lot, but I mean, there's a number of them. So I mean, how vulnerable could they be, or would they be fully protected from incoming missile fire?
They will be very well protected. And there will have been American personnel that would have been rotated out of those bases in the past couple of days because you anticipate the Iranian retaliation. But as the experience of Israel showed last June, when Iranian missiles did make it through and did hit some sensitive sites as well, you can't fully protect your bases against the missiles that Iran had at that time. I think the open question here is Iran expended a lot of missiles. It lost a lot of missile launchers in that 12-day war last June. How much do they still have left? Did they replenish their stocks? How much can they fire? So in other words, we've got the first strikes today on American bases, something that we did not have in June at all until the very end of that conflict. Is this just simply that the Iranians are firing everything they have in an opening salvo, or do they have enough to carry out counterattack after counterattack after a counterattack for several days?
Now, can I also ask you a little bit about Trump himself and where he personally, so let's narrow it down, telescope it down to just him. Obviously, he had a regime change incident a few months ago in Venezuela. We see increasing drumbeat around Cuba, possibly replacing, as he said, a friendly takeover was the phrase he used yesterday as he climbed on the helicopter. So, you know, placing this, is this just Trump's attempt to redraw the world? You know, he was, as you said, the man who wasn't going to have forever wars. It looks quite forever if you put these three incidents together. But do you think the learning he took out of Venezuela was you can change and decapitate the leadership of a foe without necessarily having body bags coming back to the United States directly? Do you think that's the lesson he personally took out of Venezuela?
Well, remember, Venezuela was not regime change. In Venezuela, they got Maduro, the president, but the rest of the Maduro regime is still in place because they reached an accommodation with the Trump folks. I just mentioned that because that's very different from what we're talking about in Iran, which is not simply getting the supreme leader out and keeping the rest of the regime there. Now, in terms of what the Americans are trying to do, and it goes beyond Donald Trump, look at the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, and the way that he poses. Look sometimes at the way that J.D. Vance poses. They're talking about American dominance. So Venezuela was part of what they declared in December in their national security strategy was going to be dominance of the Western Hemisphere. Trying to grab Greenland through threats was an attempt to extend dominance, not with an all-out military invasion, but over Europe. And this is an attempt to reestablish American dominance in Iran and in the Middle East.
Yeah, but it's to reestablish it in a particular way, unlike the Bush era. It's able to, it's the way they look at it is it's taking out leaders or, you know, imposing your agenda on them without having huge casualty figures going with them. They think they've solved that problem that would have afflicted the Bush era people in terms of both Afghanistan and Iraq. That's the point. It's kind of doing the same thing, but in a different way as they see it.
Yeah, but that's why the administration split this week, because there were reports that J.D. Vance and the American military were telling Trump, look, we're not sure if we can do it this cleanly. We're not sure that if through a few days of strikes, the regime goes. And then what do you do next? And that is a broader question for the Trump folks. And that is, it's like a dog chasing a car. You know, they can catch up to the car. They can fire all these missiles, and the Israelis can fire all these missiles. And perhaps you even have cracks in the regime. But what do you do next if elements of the regime still stay in place and refuse to surrender? And what if that regime in Iran, by the way, is then causing instability throughout the Middle East? Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, Palestine? What do you do then? So I think there is a simplistic approach here by the Trump folks. Set aside peace. It's not peace. The attempt to, you know, to basically assert power in that way through, you know, through airstrikes. But I don't think they've done it through gaming this out all the way through. And I hate to be so negative this morning, but they have set off a series of consequences that may not be contained. And then what do Trump and his camp do?
I would also, you know, point to we're going to see a big escalation, I think, in the price of crude. It was already bubbling a little bit up last week. It wasn't dramatic, but it certainly was coming through. I know there was some shipments made. So for people here in Ireland and Europe, it's not immediate because obviously oil is priced ahead. But nevertheless, we will see that economic pressure point also starting to come through pronounced way in the next few weeks and months. Let me go to my other guest, Mark Weiss, who is based in Jerusalem. Mark, from the Israeli perspective, and I want to get maybe your sense of what public sentiment will be reacting to. The population there, you know, they've had a long bruising conflict in Gaza. There's also been, of course, military engagement in Lebanon as well. Now we see Iran. We had, of course, further strikes last year as well. I mean, is there any sort of war weariness here, or do you think Netanyahu will get broadly based support for this action?
I think a lot depends on the outcome. If it's a successful outcome, and from Israel's point of view, and the regime is toppled, the Iranian nuclear threat is totally obliterated, there is no more missile threat from Iran, then that will be a very successful outcome for Prime Minister Netanyahu and will probably prompt him to call early elections and on the basis of a victory over Iran would probably win a landslide. But we're a long way from that from that scenario. As I say, we're only in the early stages of what looks like it's going to be a protracted, ongoing war, and there will, in all likelihood, be casualties here in Israel, never mind across the entire region, and never mind what happens in Iran. There is very significant support in Israel for this military operation. Polls showed more than 60% of the population over the last weeks in favour of such an attack.
Okay, listen, Mark, I'm going to have to leave talking to you there for a moment. I also want to just very briefly to return to Scott Lucas. Scott, before I let you go, we had, of course, the Clinton testimony, Hillary and Bill Clinton, former First Lady and President, in front, behind the cameras, were privately on the Epstein files. What's your overall reaction, particularly to what Bill Clinton was saying, and have they almost put the pressure back on the Republicans over events from the last 2 days?
Yeah, I think if we hadn't had the intervention this morning, so this story goes to the inside pages, it would have put pressure on Trump because both the Clintons were able to say, I think, quite effectively, and we don't have the transcripts of these hearings, they were closed, but in their statements outside the hearings, make clear, look, that you know, Hillary Clinton had no contact with Jeffrey Epstein at all. Bill Clinton had stopped contact with Epstein before that first conviction in Florida in 2008. And there's absolutely nothing, no witnesses, no records that tie him to Epstein's criminal activities, financial or the pedophilia. And then they could tell the committee, look, if you're going to bring us up here, and we have now come and testified to you, you know, when you subpoenaed us, you need to be talking to others who are in the frame. The immediate one is going to be the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, who told an untruth when he had said he'd broken contact with Epstein before 2008. But both the Clintons also said, you need to be talking to Donald Trump, because guess who the guy is who's referred to hundreds of times in the records we've seen, let alone those that are still being withheld by the Justice Department.
Okay, listen, we'll have to leave it there. Scott Lucas is a professor at UCD and a political analyst and at the Clinton Institute. So interesting connections from that point of view.
News Talk Saturday.